You hear it all the time. And it comes in many forms, but it's all essentially the same little trick. You know that they did a study and they found, or research has found, scholars tell us, or here's the one that usually shuts everybody up once you utter it, science has proven, dot, dot, dot. It's usually called in philosophical circles an appeal to diffuse authority. That is, someone simply cites an authority. Sometimes it's just they say or they have found. Who found? Did they really find it? But why does the trick work so well, and how do you respond to it, especially when you're discussing your Christian convictions? I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. It's Friday afternoon, February the 20th. We're concluding our five-part daily series today on discussing your Christian convictions with Greg Kokel today, Rhodes Scholar, that's what he calls it, and Just the Facts, Ma'am. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MY-I-E, or talkback at issuesetc.org. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, author of the new book, Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Greg, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Good to talk to you again.
Why does it work so well when someone says something like, science has proven?
Well, I think it's because we all esteem what scholars have to say, scientific or otherwise. We value them in our culture. They've earned the right to speak in their discipline. And we kind of, as a result, get the feeling that whenever they say something, then that's the end of discussion. It doesn't always occur to us that oftentimes scholars disagree amongst themselves, so they can't all be wrong just simply in virtue of the fact that they're scholars. It ought to. I mean, that would help us. It cause us to be a little bit more bold, I think, and then questioning some of the proclamations of the academic community. But I think it's an intimidating foe for people. And so when somebody you're talking with regarding Christianity or, you know, in some fashion trots out historical scholars or scientific scholars of some sort against your view, it can be very intimidating, and I understand that.
Okay, what if someone really has a scholar? I mean, they have real research. This isn't the appeal to diffuse authority. This is, in fact, an appeal to a real authority, a real piece of research or something like that, and they got an expert on their side.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you think about it, this is where the tactic Rhodes Scholar comes in. This is the name that I give to the tactic that we employ when we deal with this kind of problem. And I make a distinction, Todd, between being informed and being educated. A person who is informed is simply told what the scholar has to say, the conclusion of the scholar. Somebody who is getting educated about the matter, though, gets more information. They don't get just the point of view of the scholar. They get the reasons why the scholar came to the point of view that they came to. Now, your listeners have been listening for the last few days here as we've been talking every day this week might hear those same two Columbo questions echoing in the background there. And that's exactly what's happening here. We don't want to know just what the scholar believes. That's the first Columbo question. We want to know why he believes it. When we know what he believes, we are informed as to his opinion, but we're not in any position to draw conclusions on whether his opinion is a good one, or maybe it's been influenced by some bias or something like that. When we are given, in a sense, the rationale why they believe this, we go beyond being informed about their view. Now we're educated as to the way they think about it. And this puts us in a much better place to assess whether their conclusions are sound or not. You know, when you have an expert witness on trial, they bring a guy in to a scientist or whatever to weigh in on some matter. The expert witness doesn't get up in favor of the defense, make his point, and then get down. What follows his testimony is cross-examination. And there's a sense in which here what we want to do with the Rhodes Scholar tactic is to cross-examine the scholar to a degree. We want to know his reasons why he holds the view. Sometimes scholars are in a unique position to be in possession of the facts, and we pretty much have to take their word for it. But most of the time, their facts are available to other people to assess. It's not just a judgment call. It's just that they've learned some things that we can learn as well. We can check up on and we can assess. And you'll be surprised, Todd, and so will your listeners, at how many times scholars weigh in with a point of view, and it turns out that their bias, their personal philosophy, is deeply influencing their conclusion. And that's what we want to get at with this tactic.
So this is a bit of a tactic I see Jeff Shores, the producer of Issues, et cetera, employ almost constantly, and that is kind of, why should I take your opinion seriously?
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
So does it require expertise? I mean, that we pointed out, for instance, the author of The Da Vinci Code writes this kind of revisionist history on Christianity, and then you discover he's, what, a former high school English teacher, and you begin, even the ordinary person says, now, wait a minute.
Right. Well, that's right. Sometimes so-called scholars who write novels are not scholars at all, and even though they say their facts are true, it turns out that they're not. That actually relates to another tactic we'll talk about in a moment, just the facts, ma'am. There's a sense in which you asked, do you need to be able to be able to review the scholar or something like that, or know the facts and with regards to the academics to be able to assess them? And the answer to that is kind of a qualified yes, but it doesn't mean you have to do all the work. This is where the value of peer review comes in. I mean, sometimes you hear an academic say, you know, here's what he says against our views, and we think, gee, how do I deal with that? Well, we may not be able to deal with it, but somebody else who's an academic in that field might have offered a challenge to that view. And this is where the Internet is really good. You know, you see people, you know, an article in the newspaper or something or in the Newsweekly, and there it is, it challenges the truthfulness of something pertaining to Christianity. It's easy then to go on the Internet and see if any other Christian scholar or academic has weighed in a way that can show, well, this guy isn't using his facts right, his thinking is wrong, his biases are entering in at this particular point. And then you can see a little bit of both sides. The point here, Todd, is to encourage followers of Christ not to be blown over simply by the claim that some scholar has weighed in on this against us. What we need to figure out is, what are his reasons for weighing in the way he did? And then we'll get an idea, a clearer idea of what's going on and whether we can trust his opinion. This is also known in more technical terms as the fallacy of expert witness. Sometimes people weigh in on things and they're no expert on it at all. I remember reading, there's a cloning initiative that came up here in California, or an embryonic stem cell research initiative that came out a few years ago, and they had these Nobel laureates that were in favor of it. But when you look at their credits, it turns out they were like Nobel laureates in economics. Why should I trust a Nobel laureate's opinion about cloning or, you know, embryonic stem cell research when it's not even his field? This is an example of trotting out the academic in a way that was illegitimate.
Okay, let's do a number on one of these. It's an example included in your book, and it has to do with kind of the dying gasps of liberal Bible scholarship, the Jesus Seminar.
Yeah.
They will say the Bible contains fabrications because the Bible records events that are simply inconsistent with quote-unquote scientific views of the world. Therefore, ruled out of hand are miracles. And if Jesus appears to have predicted something that actually came to be true, that must be a later addition because people don't predict future events.
Yeah. Well, you've kind of given a hint to the answer here. Here are biblical scholars, and many of them in Jesus Seminar are academics in their own right in this field, but it doesn't mean that their biases haven't influenced something. Whenever you hear somebody say, I'm taking a scientific approach, they could mean one of two things. They could mean that they're being really careful in their methodology, the way science is, and that's noble. But the science operates in our culture nowadays not only on a certain methodology, but there's another piece to the definition, and that's a philosophical element. That is, science operates on the principles of naturalism and materialism. That is, every scientific answer you come up with has to comport with the laws of nature. Anything that's not explainable by the laws of nature, then, is not scientific. So now you've got a philosophical view that, by definition, leaves miracles out of the equation. So if somebody's going to go to the Bible then with a scientific view like that, that is, they just simply deny miracles, you see now that they have decided beforehand that there can't be any miracle, accurate historical accounts of miracles in the Gospels, because there are no miracles at all anyway, according to their presupposition, and therefore these things must be false. And they don't have to look at the evidence. They have already made their decision before the evidence has come in.
All right, let's take a break right here, because I want more on this on the other side, this idea that they have ruled out of hand. They have simply a priori said these things cannot exist, therefore they don't exist. That sounds pretty circular to me. Folks, we still have two more copies of Greg Kokel's new book, Tactics, to give away to listeners with the best questions or comments. Our call-in number this Friday afternoon, the 20th of February, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, and our in-studio email address is talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. this Friday afternoon, 20th of February. 10 more minutes with Greg Kokel on the other side of this break, giving away his book, Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. This break is a great time to call 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE, or talkback@issuesetc.org. A little bit more on Rhodes Scholar after this, and then Just the Facts, Ma'am. Stay tuned. We're talking about discussing your Christian convictions. Greg Kokel is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. talkback@issuesetc.org is our email address, and our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. We were talking before about the Jesus scholars and the way they just simply rule out of hand, even before examination of the facts, things like miracles. And then they claim that they've come to an objective conclusion. I can't help but think of the phrase, there is none so blind as those who will not see, Greg.
Yeah, that does apply here. And but it's not just them. There are a lot of people that have the same point of view. They think that the material world is all that exists, and so therefore any explanation has got to comport with that metaphysical view, or else the explanation just is spurious. This is precisely why, by the way, you will often hear the comment, creationism or intelligent design is not science. It's religion dressed up as science. Now, it's interesting in a comment like that, they are not referring to the methods that the scientists who come to creationist or ID conclusions are using. They're referring to their own philosophy that disqualifies the conclusion they come to out of hand. And this happens all the time. It's the philosophy that's doing the work, not the facts. Once you find that out, you realize that these scholars are working within certain constraints that keep them many times from coming to accurate conclusions.
Okay, this email comes from Paul in O'Fallon, Illinois. He says, in all the time that Mr. Kokel has developed and used his techniques to discuss and defend his faith and the positions with others, what would he describe as the most common outcome? I expect the people who've had their views challenged in such an effective manner get upset and may just go away mad. I would liken it to an effective application of the law, leaving the sinner with no room to hide. What has been the most common outcome?
Yeah, well, in my experience, Todd, people haven't gone away mad, but that's because of the tactical approach that I've talked about this week as part of a larger approach that I call the ambassador approach or the ambassador method or whatever, and I described that in the first chapter of Tactics. That is that we have to have our knowledge in place and we have to have our diplomatic maneuvering in place, the tactics, but we have to have our character in place too. And so I don't go out to draw a line in the sand and get people angry at me and bang heads with them, and then we each defend our own turf, and then I can say, oh, he's mad at me, but that's okay. I gave him the truth, and he didn't like it, so I, you know, dust off my feet, and, their blood's on their own head. Now, sometimes maybe their blood is on my head because I've been kind of a jerk in the process. I try to be very cordial and diplomatic in the process, even though my tactics can be pointed and show them that they've made a mistake. I don't want to get people angry at me, because when I get people angry, then they're not listening. So my experience has been people don't walk off in a huff angry. And I think if that's the experience of some Christians, they ought to ask what's making them angry. Is it the truth of the message, or is it the attitude and the conduct of the messenger? And much of the time, people are angry at the attitude and conduct of the messenger. And if that's the case, then our blood's on our own head.
Okay, let's talk just the facts, ma'am. What is it?
Well, it turns out that sometimes there are objections against our points of view that that trade simply on a misunderstanding of facts, facts of history oftentimes, or scientific facts or something like that. And so if we are in possession then of the accurate facts, we can simply say, no, you're mistaken on that particular point, because you basically have your facts wrong. So the most common and glaring example of this, Todd, is when people say that that religion has caused more wars and more bloodshed than anything else in the history of the world. Well, this is a believable concept, because we just had this attack, you know, 8 years ago or whatever, on our own country that was religiously motivated, 9/11. There are, you know, crusades and jihads of various sorts that people are aware of, and so it's easy for them to acknowledge this, and it makes people like us look bad. But the fact is that it is not religion that has caused most bloodshed in the world. It is irreligion. It is people that are deeply committed to atheism that are responsible for the highest body count, put simply. The 20th century was the bloodiest century in the history of the world, and it was the bloodiest century principally because of the institutionalization of atheism in communism. And so between three men, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao Zedong, there were more than 100 million corpses, conservatively, in the 20th century. And there's a connection between the atheism and the body count. It isn't just accidental. These people believe, since there was no God, the state was the highest arbiter, the final arbiter, because the state was the most powerful. Might makes right, and they lived this out, and this is what happened. So when when people raise this objection, it turns out that, you know, they're just misinformed, and dealing with the objection is just a matter of getting them the right facts. Of course, you got to know what the facts are in order to correct that. But one way I tell people to go about it is to listen to the challenge, then isolate the claims. What exactly are they saying? You get rid of the rhetoric and the nonsense, and then see what is the exact claim that's being made, and then ask, is it factually correct? Sometimes you'll know immediately that it's not factually correct if you just think about it for a moment. Like, when in Da Vinci Code there was some comment about how many witches had been burned during the medieval period. I mean, when you do the math based on the claim, you know, there weren't even that many people in Europe, you know, hardly. So some things are obviously wrong when you think about them for a moment. If your dentist says he's filled a half a million fillings, you know, he didn't live that long, you know, so you can do the math there. But the key here is to getting to the facts and seeing if the facts that are behind the point of view are really accurate or not. That's just the facts, ma'am.
Okay, your two best pieces of advice under the heading of more sweat, less blood, that is, yeah, really getting yourself ready for this, learning,
sure,
from your mistakes. Your two best pieces of advice with about a minute and a half or so.
Okay, well, the title says More Sweat, Less Blood, and it's based on a Marine Corps dictum. In training, the Marines are told the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. So with that regard, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Do your homework. Practice in advance. If you want to go out there and, in a sense, mix it up for the Lord and do spiritual battle by engaging with people in the cause of Christ as an ambassador, if you do your homework, it's going to be a lot easier. It's that simple. Do your homework. Read the book. Practice the things, read other things. The more you prepare, the better off you'll be. That's the first principle. The second one is that it's really a good idea to try to connect with other people in your spiritual community that are kind of kindred spirits. I call them the dry tinder. In other words, some people want to get their whole church fired up about this stuff they're learning, but, you know, you can't make a fire with wet wood. You got to find the dry tinder. You got to find those that are like you, and then you band together in small groups. And once you get that little fire burning, that'll sometimes dry out the other wet wet wood. So find people in your community that are excited about these kinds of things. There's always a few in every church, and you get together and connect with them, and then between you, you can encourage each other in these kinds of things.
Finally, then, with less than a minute, what do you say to someone who says, look, I'm just not smart enough or assertive enough to discuss my Christian convictions with others? I'm scared.
Well, this is the value of the game plan. There are two things that help overcome fear. In any situation, this is a general principle, Todd, the two things are knowledge and action. Knowledge and action. Tactics is meant to give you the knowledge, at least enough to have a game plan to direct your action. So you have two questions you start out with. What do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? Now you got to step out. When people are fearful, if they can just get themselves moving forward, open their mouth, ask that first question, just get involved and engaged in a conversation, they will be amazed at how much courage they develop because they've stepped out.
Folks, check out Greg Kokel's new book, Tactics, at our website, issuezetc.org. Click on demand. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, author of the new book, Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. Greg, I cannot thank you enough for the amount of time that you've devoted to this.
Thanks to you, Todd. It's been a great week talking together.
Happy to do it. Paul in O'Fallon, if you would email us your mailing address, we'd be happy to send you Greg Kokel's book, Tactics. Thank you very much for your contribution to the conversation today. Folks, if you've enjoyed listening to our discussion this week with Greg Kokel on discussing your Christian convictions, please consider making a tax-deductible gift this weekend to help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. You can donate online. Issuesetc.org is our website, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support of Issues, Etc. Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. Monday on the program, we'll be talking about theories of the atonement. Believe it or not, there are more than one, and some of them are in hot dispute in Christendom. It's a five-part series with Dr. Stephen Hine on theories of the atonement. We don't have the luxury of choosing the battle. We don't have the luxury of choosing where it will be fought or when it will be fought. The opportunities will arise. They will come our way. We need to be ready to give an answer for the hope that is in us, that hope which is Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.